I'm going to be really boring. You're going to be super exciting. So would you introduce yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm Midjour, ex-Ultravox, Visage, and a million others.
A million? And this is the thing is, you see, I usually do revisionist history. And with you, it's like where to start. But one of the things that I don't think 98% of the world knows, unless they really dig in, is the reversal of Jim story. So give me the 30-second version of that, because I've seen that in print a lot, but I really haven't heard you say it a lot. But I mean, heck, why couldn't there be two Jims in a band?
I don't know. I was young, and I suppose I joined my first band. One of the leaders of the band was one of the brothers, and his name was Jim. And he said, well, you know, my name's James, Jim. So he said, we can't have two Jims in the band. I'm the leader, so therefore you're now Midge. And he just flipped the name. But like most nicknames, you don't ask for them, you know, and I certainly didn't ask for that one. Especially over here, knowing that Midge is isn't it Barbie's friend? So I'm a female in America.
Glasgow, back then, when you were growing up, as opposed to now where it is this art center, even as recently as a decade ago, that was a really rough place. It was a real inner city, and it was even different than Liverpool. All the things that you write about, which you write a lot about life and about where life could have gone, and you know the moment, and my favorite quote, you know, the moment you're born, you know, your life starts ticking away. So did that environment kind of stick with you in everything you've done in terms of the way that you now write?
I think a basic, or probably less than basic, working class environment is a great environment to kind of nurture ideas. It's an environment to get out of. And that's why you'll find that most working class areas, you get great sportsmen, you get great sports people, because they strive to be good at what they're good at. You know, they're naturally good at football, they're naturally good at running, they're naturally good at whatever, gymnastics. And they develop that in order to get away from the roots that they started with. Just like anyone, you know, you get a job and you want to do better in your job so you get better paid and you can move away from the area. So you just have to look back at musical history and see that 99% of great music that's ever been written has been written by the working classes. It doesn't come from the middle classes that much. It doesn't come from the upper classes. It comes from the working classes. So although I didn't think that my past would have shaped too much of my future, because I didn't think about it until I really started writing songs, it does shape your future. It does shape who you become. It's, you know, the teachers you have, the schools you go to, you know, the punch in the nose because you happen to be the wrong religion. All of those things leave a mark, and it's something to learn from and move away from. So in Glasgow, everything was about religion, and I thought, well, you know what, music's really got nothing to do with religion, you know, populist music. So music to me was infinitely more interesting than kicking a ball about the street.
Where was that moment that it goes from blue collar, where was that turning point where it suddenly all became very fashionable? And we're going to go down that road, but if I were to put a dotted line through everything, it wasn't only about where you came from, but somewhere you got out of that, not from the lyrics, but from the look and the feel of everything you've done.
Well, I think there is a moment where it kind of transcends what you're hoping to do into you're actually doing it without realizing you're doing it. And you know, after joining the Rich Kids and you know, breaking the band up by buying a synthesizer, you know, I had this dream in my head, this vision of you know, utilizing this modern technology with traditional rock instrumentation. But the band hated it, half the band hated it, but half the band loved it. And we went on to form Visage, you know, making music to play in the clubs that Rusty and Steve Strange were running. At that point, it became, there was a mystique about that. There was something quite exclusive about it. So it was kind of working class exclusive. But, you know, like all the media wanted to come and see what was going on. There was a little buzz, a little exciting thing happening that they weren't part of. So therefore, they were desperate to get in. I mean, there's a great story about how Mick Jagger was turned away from the Blitz Club because he wasn't cool enough to be in there. And of course, that's something that if you look at it, you think, hold on a second, this stops becoming working class aspirations into fashion-orientated, fashion-driven, fashion idealism. because you're creating something that everybody else wants to be part of. So you became, instead of the follower, you became the leader at that point. I don't know if it changed any of our minds psychologically, but it certainly changed everything else.
The Blitz Club. Now, it just so happens, and you know how you never know how your life's going to go in order. So I was at South by Southwest and saw Soul Boys of the Western World, was there for the premiere, and then spent a lot of time with your label partners there. The Spandau Ballet Boys, as you know, are back together and they're back in and recording. Did you ever think if you made that left turn into Thin Lizzy, you might have and stayed, that wouldn't have been the scene?
It was never on the cards, I have to say. I mean, you know, there are moments you think, you know, if you turn left instead of turning right, what would have happened? You know, had I joined the Pistols when I was asked to do so, what would have happened then? You know, I can't look back at those moments. You know, you've got to be driven by your heart and your senses. And, you know, the Pistols thing was just instinctively wrong. It was wrong, you know, because having been asked to join the band, I realised they hadn't asked if I was a musician. I thought, that's just not right.
McLaren, but come on, that story is so well told that McLaren was, you know, it's kind of like the boy bands, right? It was an early boy, but he was looking for a musician. He was looking for a look.
He had an agenda. He wanted to sell some clothes. You know, but that, or Thin Lizzy, you know, Thin Lizzy. I'd already joined Ultravox when I did the Thin Lizzy stint. So for me, in my mind, although it was great fun and it was fabulous to do, and it gave me much needed income at a time when I had to invest in Ultravox. I had to buy the equipment that I needed for Ultravox. But my heart was with Ultravox, even though, you know, Lizzy were a big band at the time, and it was easy, it would have been easy to join Lizzy. But with Ultravox, we had just been dropped by a record label, they owed a fortune, they had no prospects. But as a sound, as a noise, when we got together, it was the most magnificent thing I'd ever heard. So that was where my heart lay.
But what's fascinating, and I did a little my own, on the way down here, my own little Ultravox revisit. Not that I don't play it all the time, but I'm listening to Vienna, and I'm thinking, where did you realize that Ultravox, you know, could have either fit or not fit at all? Because you put out a song like Vienna, you put out, you know, nothing, everything connected because it's your voice, everything connected because, yes, there are synths in there. But it's not like you came out with, as you know, John Peel used to say, that wasn't a banger that you came out with there.
No, I remember distinctly when we got together to make the Vienna album, and of course Vienna felt, the track felt quite special. We used to play it at the end of each mix day, you know, just for a buzz, just for the vibe of playing it and go, wow, that's, oh yeah, that's really interesting. And it was interesting because it wasn't like anything else that had been before, nothing that we'd ever created, nothing we ever thought we would do. So we were young and naive and finding our way, but finding our way with a belief that what we were doing was right, to the extent that when Vienna was the third track from the album to be released as a single, and it was the third track because our record company insisted that we edit the track down, and we said, well, okay, where, how do you do it? It's a piece of music, it has a flow, it has a feel, it has a bit.
Take the middle out, just take the middle eight out,
take the viola solo out, yeah, you know, what, yeah, or do we, out. What do we do, you know, do you lose the intro? It's one of the most interesting intros ever with that heartbeat drum thing. So eventually, you know, we fought them all the way. We said, it either goes out in its entirety or it doesn't go out at all. And that's naivety speaking. You know, maybe later on you'd be bending over backwards to make sure you got it right so that it was commercially palatable or whatever. We didn't care. We had written something that we thought was interesting, and given half a chance, the world might find it interesting. So, you know, I think naivety plays a huge part in what people do and what making music that maybe shifts the world on its axis a little. It's what it does. You know, Kate Bush was very naive when she wrote Wuthering Heights, but what a difference that track made. You know, I suppose, you know, Queen were probably when they were doing Bohemian Rhapsody, you think, well, they weren't quite sure what they were doing, but they created something that shifted the dynamic. You know, all of a sudden it wasn't about 3-minute singles, it was about 6-minute singles, it was about epics, it was about, you know, the vastness that you could create.
It's about narrative.
It was, but absolutely, it told a story. It was all about, you know, not the 3-minute hit, not the sing-along part, it was give people a piece of music, give them the opportunity to hear something that lasts longer than 3 minutes, and they might just like it.
This penchant that you do have for wanting to change the world. And when I say change the world, you know, musically, you've never gone down the path. That's the accepted path by any stretch. And you write what you talk about, you know, what you talk about, what you write about, you feel. So just getting relatively recent, but you've never stopped. When you started saying, okay, wait a minute, now I'm a musician, I have a lot of fans, I can do more. I can do more with life. I grew up in blue collar, and then there's the rest of this world out there that really needs my help. So where was that pivotal, and here are Boomtown Rats, of all things, about to go on tour again. But where was that moment that you realized that you were also going to have, and I'm not being religious here, but a greater calling and, you know, Band-Aid and all the other things that you're involved in?
Well, I don't think it happened until after Band-Aid, and I have to be absolutely brutally honest about it. You know, I did what everyone does, you know, you put your hand in your pocket and you donate, and that's it. But that's not involving, that's not committing, that's just getting it done and making your conscience feel a little bit better. But after Band-Aid, you know, of course you cannot get embroiled in something like that. You cannot get involved in something like that and go to third world countries and taste it and smell it and be part of it and then think, ah, oh, right, okay, I've done my bit now and I'll just walk away from it. We created something that was a long-term project. We didn't see it at the time. We thought it was going to be a six-month project doing the Band-Aid record. That record, I mean, figure this out, right? We're reasonably intelligent people. Not one of us thought, oh, this is a Christmas song. Maybe this will get played every year. Maybe this will, there'll be an annual event. Maybe this will be covered by various people. Maybe there'll be various versions of this. We just made a record to raise £100,000. You know, it went way beyond that. And of course, the legacy, one of the legacies it has, is that that thing gets played every Christmas, every October. You know, you guys,
I pull out the 12-inch every year.
Well, you guys have these stations over here that play nothing but Christmas records, and I've heard them, and it's quite bizarre. Yeah. And there it is, in there, you know, in between, you know, Gene Autry and, you know,
there it is,
a Pops Band-Aid. And every time it's played in the radio, it generates income. So the writing royalties that Bob and I donated to the Band-Aid Trust still come in and still go through the process and go end up in Africa. So so it's something that you think, you cannot get involved in this and then think, well, I've done my bit. I'll now leave it to someone else. I'll now walk away and let someone else take over. Because it doesn't really work that way. You know, you do it, it's your baby. You know, it's like you can't just say, well, I've sent the kids off to school. Yep. It's now the rest of their lives are theirs. You have to keep looking after this thing, you know. So that's exactly what we've been doing.
When you got your first doctorate, and there are five, right? So when you got that first one, did you, and again, I know you're not self-referential. I know as a human being, you don't think of yourself that way. But there must have been some sort of reference where you just said, wow, I really have done what I set out to do when I was younger, which is through music and through lyrics and through words and through opinions, I've affected something here.
Well, I have to say, I'm probably much more basic than that. You know, I think my initial thing was, you know, to hell with Miss Thompson, who told me when I was 12 that I'd never amount to anything, you know. There you go, and you know, and that's you know, it's
but that's visceral and that's real.
Of course, it's real. It's a knee jerk reaction. You think, yes, fantastic. So someone's actually given me a pat on the back. It's a bit like being called up in front of the head in front of the entire school, and someone said, well written essay, Mr. Ewer. That's very good. You know, it's the equivalent of that. But it was fantastic. It was lovely to have. You know, my children think it's hysterical that I've got all these doctorates and haven't really worked for them. I haven't earned them.
So, Fragile, 10 to 12 years, that's a lot of thinking.
It's a lot of doubt, I have to say. It's not really a lot of thinking. You know, no album's worth 12 years of hard graft. It's ridiculous. If it takes 12 years to make something, you're doing it wrong. You know, so I started messing around with some ideas 10, 12 years ago, got myself in a bit of personal trouble with some alcohol, which I'd been doing for quite a while, but I got to the point where I realised that my brakes weren't working and I couldn't stop. So I did something about it, and when I'd sorted all that out, I had huge self-doubt as to whether I could do it on my own without the alcohol. And then when I realised I could do it without the alcohol, I had huge amounts of doubt as to whether I wanted to do it. I didn't want to be part of a music industry that had changed so much, changed beyond all recognition. It wasn't the same industry that I joined, because over the last 10, 20 years, you know, we live in a world where music is still consumed at a huge rate, but it's not paid for, it's not invested in, it's not nurtured. I was talking to someone recently, and I have a lot of guitars, and they said to me, what's your favourite guitar? I said, well, the one that I paid for, the one that I saved up money and bought because I'm connected to that guitar, because it means something to me. And if you don't pay for something, it's disposable, and music has become disposable. So I had huge doubts as to whether I wanted to be part of this industry anymore. And that took me a long time to kind of try and resolve.
So I've invented a thing that I call a musical sandwich, and I've done this with about 500 artists. And what it is two of your songs on the outside, and then anything else off the top of your head in between. And there are no rules.